following is a previously broadcast program.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. This month, Democracy Now! Is celebrating our 26th anniversary. That's 26 years of bringing you the stories and voices you won't hear anywhere else. We maintain our editorial independence thanks to you. Please donate today at democracynow.org and help us stay on the air for decades to come. Thank you so much. And remember, wearing a mask is an act of love. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We don't know precisely how things will play out, but here's what the world can expect to see unfold. In fact, it's unfolding right now, today, as Russia takes steps down the path to war and reissued the threat of military action.
Speaking before the United Nations Security Council, Secretary of State Tony Blinken accuses Russia of preparing to stage a false flag operation to justify an invasion of Ukraine. But Russia continues to deny any plans to attack. We'll speak with a Russian journalist who helped author an open letter from Russian and American women calling for peace. Then, as we continue to mark Black History Month, we speak with the acclaimed filmmaker Stanley Nelson, whose new documentary, Attica, about the 1971 prison rebellion and massacre, was just nominated for his first Academy Award.
Put your hands in the air, and you will not be harmed.
You will not be harmed.
You will not be harmed.
But that was good.
Man. He was waking up America.
We'll also speak with Stanley Nelson about his upcoming documentaries on Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman and his past film on historically Black colleges and universities in light of the recent bomb threats targeting HBCUs, more than 20 this year alone. They were the focus of dramatic congressional hearing on Thursday. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov have agreed to meet next week as tensions remain high over Ukraine. On Thursday, President Biden said there's a very high threat of a Russian invasion of Ukraine and that Russia might stage a false flag operation to justify an attack. Secretary of State Blinken repeated the claim when he addressed the U.N. Security Council.
We don't know exactly the form it will take. It could be a fabricated so-called terrorist bombing inside Russia, the invented discovery of a mass grave, a staged drone strike against civilians, or a fake, even a real, attack using chemical weapons.
Russia's U.N. ambassador blasted Blinken's comments as political posturing. Russia's foreign ministry insists no invasions being planned and said the U.S. and NATO are seeking to pressure and devalue Russia's proposals for security guarantees. On Thursday, Ukraine and Russian-backed separatists in the Donbas region accused each other of violating a ceasefire agreement. Meanwhile, Russia's announced plans to stage massive drills on Saturday of its nuclear forces. Today, President Biden's hosting a phone call with NATO allies. Meanwhile, Vice President Kamala Harris is attending the Munich Security Conference, where she'll speak with the president of Ukraine and a dozen other heads of state. We'll have more on Russia, NATO, and Ukraine after headlines. Coronavirus cases are surging in many Asian countries as the Omicron variant spreads throughout the region. In Hong Kong, quarantine facilities are full and 95% of hospital beds are occupied. As authorities said, they'll reduce the duration of hospital and supervised isolation stays for some patients to ease the strain on the health system. Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, said she's finalizing plans to have all city residents get tested for COVID. Malaysia and South Korea also reported record caseloads this week, with South Korea topping 100,000 daily infections for the first time. A New York judge has ordered Donald Trump Jr., and Ivanka Trump to testify in New York Attorney General Letitia James' fraud investigation into the Trump Organization within the next 3 weeks. Trump has also been directed to hand over documents to the AG's office within 2 weeks. James is investigating whether the Trump Organization lied about the value of its assets to obtain loans and tax benefits. Florida's State House has approved Republican-led legislation that would ban abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. The bill mirrors a Mississippi anti-abortion law currently under review by the U.S. Supreme Court that threatens to severely weaken or overturn the landmark 1973 Roe v. Wade ruling that legalized abortion nationwide. The measure could be approved by Florida's full state legislature as early as next week. Over 1 in 4 women in the world have experienced domestic violence before they turn 50. That's according to a new study published by the Lancet Medical Journal, which compiled statistics on physical and sexual violence against women from the years 2000 to 2018. The data was based on self-reported experiences, and authors warn the real scale of the crisis may be far worse, as many cases are not reported due to stigma and fear. The COVID-19 pandemic likely exacerbated domestic violence, with women and girls often forced to stay home with their abusers without access to support services. In Haiti, labor protests continue as factory workers demand a wage increase in worsening economic conditions and political instability. Workers are demanding a salary of $15 a day. They currently make just $5 a day. This is one of thousands of demonstrators who took to the streets Thursday.
We have earned the 1,500 gourds we are demanding. It is not normal that the U.S. clothing retailers are earning millions while I am paid in cents. It makes no sense. We are giving our blood.
Many North American companies source from factories in Haiti that pay exploitive wages and force people to work in sweatshop conditions. Local reports say the protesters work for U.S. brands including Gap, Walmart, Target, and Canada's Gildan Activewear. In Brazil, the death toll from massive flooding and mudslides in the city of Petropolis, triggered by some of the most intense rains seen in decades, rose to at least 117 Thursday. Over 100 people are missing. Survivors dug through debris, collapsed homes and structures, trying to find loved ones as rescue efforts continue. This is a Petropolis resident.
I've got no words. I'm destroyed. Destroyed because of everything we've lost. Our neighbors, our friends, the house, that doesn't matter. We are alive. What about those who passed away?
In Canada, police say they're investigating after an overnight attack at a Coastal GasLink pipeline worksite in British Columbia. Coastal GasLink says their workers were attacked, though none were injured and millions of dollars in damages were incurred, they said. There have been no arrests or identified suspects thus far. Indigenous communities have mounted a years-long resistance against the pipeline, which is built on sovereign First Nations land. Local activists are warning last night's events could enable a further crackdown on Indigenous and environmental groups. India has sentenced 38 Muslim men to death over a string of bombings in the western city of Ahmedabad in 2008 that killed dozens of people and injured hundreds of others. The death sentences capped a trial that spanned nearly a decade. The court found a group calling itself the Indian Mujahideen carried out the attacks as revenge for 2002 anti-Muslim riots in Gujarat state that left more than 1,000 people dead. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi was at the time the chief minister of Gujarat. He's been accused of turning a blind eye to the violence. A warning to our audience, the next stories contain graphic accounts of police violence and racist killings. In Minneapolis, mourners gathered Thursday for the funeral of Amir Locke, the 22-year-old black man who was fatally shot by police officers executing a no-knock warrant on February 2nd. Body camera video of the incident shows Locke appeared to be asleep on a couch wrapped in a blanket when a SWAT team entered the apartment. White police officer Mark Hanneman shot Locke 3 times, opening fire less than 9 seconds into the raid. On Thursday, the Reverend Al Sharpton delivered Locke's eulogy, saying Amir was not guilty of anything but being young and black in America. His aunt Linda Taylor also spoke.
We don't want to continue to hear about being a police officer. It's a difficult job. You have to make split decisions. You fear for your life. You were not drafted into the police department. You chose that profession. And if you think being a police officer is a difficult profession, try to be a black man.
Amir Locke's aunt, Linda Tyler. In St. Paul, Minnesota, the federal civil rights trial of three former police officers involved in George Floyd's murder continued Thursday. During cross-examination, former Minneapolis officer Jaggs Alexander King admitted he laughed at a joke made by Derek Chauvin, the senior officer at the scene, as Chauvin kneeled on Floyd's neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. King also acknowledged he could have performed CPR on Floyd after he became unresponsive, but failed to do so. In Georgia, jurors at the federal hate crimes trial of Ahmaud Arbery's murderers on Thursday were shown graphic images of Arbery's autopsy. One juror asked the judge if there was money for counseling available after hearing racist language used by the killers and after viewing images of the damage to Arbery's body caused by two close-range blasts from Travis McMichael's 12-gauge shotgun. In Texas, a grand jury has indicted 19 Austin police officers on charges of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon for their roles in violently suppressing Black Lives Matter protests in 2020. News of the indictments came just hours after Austin approved a $10 million settlement with two protesters injured by police, including 20-year-old Texas State University student Justin Howell, who suffered brain damage when he was shot in the head with a lead pellet bag fired by an officer's shotgun. And the New Jersey NAACP is calling on the Bridgewater Police Department to remove two police officers filmed breaking up a fight by violently arresting a black teen while allowing an older white teen to remain free. Video of Saturday's incident at a shopping mall shows 14-year-old Kai Hussein, who's black, intervening to stop a 16-year-old white teen from bullying his younger friend. The older teen shoves Kai, and the two begin trading blows. 14 seconds into the fight, a pair of white police officers arrive and pull the boys apart. One officer wrestles Kai to the floor, puts his knee on the boy's back. The other officer pushes the white teen onto a couch and motions him to remain still. She then joins the other officer, pressing her knee into Kai's shoulder near his neck. Kai is then handcuffed, while the older white teen, who instigated the fight, looks on and is not arrested. The video ends with a bystander's comments.
Yo, it's because he's black. Racially motivated.
On Wednesday, New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy called the video deeply disturbing and promised an investigation. Kai's mother, Ebony, told CNN racism clearly played a role in the officer's disparate treatment of the two boys.
I hate to say this, but if it wasn't for race, then what is it? What made them tackle my son, not the other kid? What made them be so aggressive with my son, not the other kid? Why is the other kid sitting down looking at my son be humiliated and put into cuffs? It just doesn't make sense. And it makes me angry.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. Secretary of State Tony Blinken and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov have agreed to meet next week as tension remains high over Ukraine. On Thursday, President Biden said there's a, quote, very high threat of a Russian invasion of Ukraine. Biden said Russia might stage a, quote, false flag operation to justify an attack. Secretary of State Blinken repeated the claim when he addressed the U.N. Security Council Thursday.
We don't know precisely how things will play out. But here's what the world can expect to see unfold. In fact, it's unfolding right now, today, as Russia takes steps down the path to war and reissued the threat of military action. First, Russia plans to manufacture a pretext for its attack. This could be a violent event that Russia will blame on Ukraine, or an outrageous accusation that Russia will level against the Ukrainian government. We don't know exactly the form it will take. It could be a fabricated so-called terrorist bombing inside Russia, the invented discovery of a mass grave, a staged drone strike against civilians, or a fake, even a real, attack using chemical weapons.
Blinken also made a remark during a speech that was widely viewed as a reference to false intelligence presented by former Secretary of State Colin Powell about Iraq's alleged weapons of mass destruction nearly 20 years ago.
I'm mindful that some have called into question our information, recalling previous instances where intelligence ultimately did not bear out. But let me be clear. I am here today not to start a war, but to prevent one.
So we'll be speaking before the U.N. Security Council. Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Vyershinin slammed Blinken's claim that Russia would carry out a false flag operation.
Now, as regards to the alleged prepared aggression of Russia against Ukraine, this was done by the Secretary of State of the United States, and he listed the provocations that could be used as a pretext to invade Ukraine. This is regrettable. I would even go so far as to say that they are dangerous because they bring in more tensions into the already tense atmosphere. But these are words and statements. We made a large number of statements at various levels which underscore what it is that we propose and what we intend to do. But it's very unfortunate that those statements at the highest level that came out of Moscow were not heeded. But those are statements. What do we have that are actual facts? The fact is that the Russian forces were in the Russian territory and remain on the Russian territory.
The war of words at the United Nations came as Ukraine and Russian-backed separatists in the Donbas region accused each other of violating a ceasefire agreement. Meanwhile, Russia's announced plans to stage massive drills Saturday of its nuclear forces. The exercises will reportedly include multiple practice missile launches. This all comes as talks continue. President Biden's hosting a phone call today with NATO allies. Vice President Kamala Harris is attending the Munich Security Conference, where she's scheduled to speak with the president of Ukraine, the German chancellor, as well as the head of NATO. Earlier this week, a group of Russians and Americans released a joint letter calling for peace. For more, we go to Warsaw, Poland, to speak with the Russian journalist Nadezhda Azhgihina. She is the director of PEN Moscow and is usually based in Moscow. She authored the open letter titled Independent American and Russian Women Call for Peace. It was published in the independent media outlet Novaya Gazeta and the Nation magazine. In the letter's introduction, she writes, quote, "For the last few weeks, I felt I'm watching a horror film in which Russia and America accuse each other and discuss the possible consequences of conflict." Nadezhda Azhgihina, welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us from Warsaw, where you are for a few days. What is happening? What do you understand is the cause why this conflict has escalated to this point?
Good morning. Thank you very much. I'm proud to be with you, and I'm very happy to talk about our joint initiative when Russian and American women applied to everybody and called for peace. And our letter is distributed now in many social networks and published already in one more independent media in Russia, New Izvestia New News. And I think it's very important because we suggest, we call for an alternative, because war rhetorics, which we have everywhere, it's ubiquitous, it's really dangerous. And it is time to stop it. It is time to offer an alternative, to offer, to call for creative diplomacy, as it was told in our letter, and to raise our voices for peace. Many people do not believe that their voices matter, but it is. And it is important to listen to people and listen to women. And women are usually neglected during top-level discussions. And I'm happy that people who subscribe to this letter, 12 women from Russia and 12 women from the United States originally, we have already experience of dialogue, what started during perestroika in the 90s. And we have this dialogue for around a year under the umbrella of Women Transforming Our Nuclear Legacy. It's an online dialogue from Russian and American women. And we discuss different issues, consequences of radiation on women's health, domestic violence, Russian-American feminist cooperation, education, COVID situation. And last summer, we already prepared an open letter, a call before Russian-American summit to presidents to remind about danger of nuclear weapons, of nuclear armament. It was very important. So our natural intention in the beginning of 2022, when we faced this enormous tension, I do not remember anything like this in my life, to call for peace and to remind that nuclear weapons is a real threat, and our countries have 90% of it. And we should step down, and we should not increase this military aggressive rhetoric, which is really dangerous.
Nadezhda, in the letter you write, at a time when poverty is increasing in the U.S., Ukraine, and Russia, when the world collectively faces the existential threat of climate change, a pandemic that's taken 5.8 million lives and caused rising deaths of despair, declining life expectancy, and extreme inequality, isn't it time to think anew? Can you talk about how the Russian people feel about this?
Russian people feel that it would be the best to think about our everyday life, about people need, about climate. We, you know, we live in a global world. We cannot divide because one country from another, because climate change is for everybody. Nuclear threat is for everybody. Nothing could happen after that. And we should join our efforts to combat diseases, not only COVID, because many people lost their lives not only from this virus, but from different consequences, from lack of proper medical care about other diseases. We have plenty of things to think about and to unite our efforts for that. And I do believe we could. And Russian-American relationship, you know, more than 200 centuries. And we experienced very different epochs of cooperation, combat together with Nazi army, joint efforts in space and so on and so forth. And I do believe we could come to better situation in this field.
Can you describe how the Russian media is dealing with this? I mean, in the U.S., we have a media that clearly is bringing out the voices of people who are beating the drums for war. Are you hearing other voices like yours?
You know, Russian media, like media everywhere, is in crisis. We have a number of independent media. We have state propaganda. And I would like to remind you that not now, but several years ago, probably after Obama's statement that Russia was a second-rate regional state, some propagandists began to remind our audience that Russia had nuclear weapons. And propaganda of war, you know, it existed all the time. Unfortunately, now we face a situation of so-called post-truth world, and the journalism is in crisis. Journalism does not count on facts as much as before, and the opinions are number one. Facts are not that important. People do not prove facts, and it's a dramatic situation. And I should tell you that what about Russia? Of course, in Russian media, you could hear different voices, but Russian media landscape is very puzzled. People who focus on official propaganda, they usually do not pay attention to social networks, to independent media, and vice versa. It's a pity. But I should tell you that nobody from people I know, this, despite what political orientation, what are their priorities, and so on, nobody believes in real war. But everybody is afraid of this war rhetoric, which is really threatening. And very,
what is driving this now, Nadezhda? What do you believe is driving this push for war now?
I think that those war rhetorics is like all other things are like arguments in political discussion. And it's really dangerous because discussion could be different. The discussion could be much more peaceful, much less aggressive. And those arguments in my country, which experienced awful wars. And during Second World War, which is great patriotic war in Russia, more than 27 million people died and have been killed. And every family remembers it. But unfortunately, those people who do remember the war, they are passing away. Very few of them are still alive, and they are very old. And for young people, war looks like a sort of computer game, and it is threatening. That's why I do believe it's very important to remind about real price of the war, about real danger of the war. And we should change these rhetorics, because the words matter. It is very important to use proper words, not to have this aggression rhetoric.
Nadezhda Gihina, we thank you so much for being with us. Russian journalist, director of Penn Moscow, authored an open letter titled Independent American and Russian Women Call for Peace, published earlier this week in Russia and the United States in The Nation magazine. Coming up next, we spend the rest of the hour with the acclaimed documentarian Stanley Nelson. His new documentary, Attica, about the 1971 prison rebellion and massacre, was just nominated for his first Academy Award. Stay with us.
Watch the heavens crack as the markets fell. Out the promised black of the ether, in aesthetics wall, energy six wear. Out this chronic ache through an Easter, constructing frameworks of crossing tears and paper trails till you can't breathe. Spirit led in as the day is long. Think back to the safety of your skin, to rot outside the cave they left you in.
Fiscal Weeks by Heaven's Camera. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. This week marks more than 60... Well, that rather, this week, more than 60 educational groups called on Congress to take immediate steps to support and protect historically black colleges and universities known as HBCUs after a wave of bomb threats against them. Federal authorities say more than a dozen HBCUs nationwide received bomb threats this month alone. February is Black History Month. This is Dr. David Wilson, president of one of the HBCUs, Morgan State University, testifying Thursday at a congressional hearing on the violent intimidation.
As a young black boy growing up in rural, segregated Jim Crow Alabama on a sharecropping plantation, who was not permitted to, of course, attend school full time until I was in the seventh grade, I have experienced firsthand this type of trauma and this type of racial violence, if you will. And this is why I have devoted my entire career to providing educational leadership to campuses, to enable them to nurture the intellectual growth of black students and not to stifle it. And it is so unfortunate that there is so much hatred in our nation today, being held by those who are trying to simply prevent HBCUs from educating a disproportionate number of black students. Yes, the vast majority of these more than 100 institutions have been around since the mid-19th century. And from their inception, they have just simply been targets of domestic terrorism.
David Wilson is president of Morgan State University, testifying remotely before the House committee. Just on Thursday, a bomb threat paused classes at Fayetteville State University in North Carolina before classes resumed at the 155-year-old school established shortly after the Civil War. Today, we spend the rest of the hour with the legendary documentarian Stanley Nelson, who's made more than 30 films about the Black American experience, including a 2017 PBS documentary on the pivotal role played by historically Black colleges and universities in shaping Black life, creating a Black middle class, and dismantling segregation. Nelson's received his first Oscar nomination for his new film about Attica, the prison uprising. We'll talk about that in a minute. But first, this trailer for Tell Them We're Rising, the story of Black colleges and universities.
The question for African Americans has always been, what is education's purpose? Who controls it? And what is the relationship of education to the broader aspirations of our people?
The more the system denies you the chance to read and to write, the more that becomes a prize that you must have.
Black colleges were redefining what it meant to be Black in America. You were pursuing a career where intellect mattered.
An educated Black population could not be an enslaved Black population.
If you weren't out there demonstrating, then something had to be wrong with your school.
We wanted freedom now. But whites were not prepared for any changes here.
I think they should be kept out any way possible.
A slaveholder could work a slave to death. He could rape a slave. He could do virtually anything but teach a slave how to read or write.
As soon as the war breaks out, the first thing they want is to get an education.
They wanted those schools to be as free as possible from paternalism, from racism, whether subtle or blatant. Said you
better let my... Movements are easily birthed on HBCU's campuses.
We must love and protect each other.
We're all going through the same experience.
HBCU is somewhere where I can be completely myself.
The Black college experience provides the place to be in the majority. That is such a unique and empowering experience.
This HBCU experience has taught me that anything is possible as long as you have that one spark.
Tell Them We're Rising, the story of Black colleges and universities, the 2017 film by Stanley Nelson, one of the leading documentarians of the Black American experience. Stanley, welcome back to Democracy Now! In a moment, we're going to talk about the film you've been nominated for an Oscar for, Attica. But can you talk about the significance of HBCUs and the threats they're facing right through to today, this dramatic congressional hearing that took place yesterday on the bomb threats?
First off, Amy, thank you so much for having me on. You know, the significance of HBCUs, you know, cannot be overstated. You know, it's probably been the biggest pusher for African Americans to come into the middle class. You know, my parents both went to HBCUs. You know, the significance of HBCUs can't be, you know, it's just amazing. And I think it's really significant because HBCUs, many of them were formed right after the Civil War. And so they've been around for over 150 years. And I think the threat that they're under now is really significant and really is really telling, because it's kind of like where this country is, that 150 years after their formation, once again, they're under threat. When they were first formed in the 1870s, 1880s, they were burned and under threat. And now, 150 years later, they're under threat again.
And how have HBCUs developed, what has changed over these years and the role they play in American society and the stress, especially during the pandemic, that these schools face?
I think one of the it's really interesting because in many ways, the role they play is very similar to the role they played early on. You know, they've always played a role for African-Americans to get an education who might not get an education in any other way. So for when they were first formed, African-Americans were not allowed in colleges. Today, African-Americans, you know, are allowed in colleges, but the grade school education, the high school education that African-Americans get so many times is inferior. So still, HBCUs are a way for African-Americans to go to college, and many of them then go on to mainstream institutions for graduate school and are kind of vaulted into the middle class. So I think in many ways, the role that they play is really similar for the role that they played historically.
And the development of Black leadership in the United States, the number of people who have gone who are leaders all different professions.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we can name them, you know, from Kamala Harris to, you know, W.B. Du Bois, you know. So, you know, they've played a huge role. And in so many ways, there was one little bit of that clip you played. You know, they're in many ways still like Wakanda for African Americans. You know, it's a way for 4 years of your life to be in the majority, for 4 years of your life, maybe, just maybe, to be away from the racism and the racially charged atmosphere that's so prevalent in the United States.
We're going to break and then come back to your latest film, Attica, that's streaming free on YouTube for Black History Month, that was just nominated for an Academy Award, your first, Stanley Nelson, leading documentarian. Stay with us. Blues by Ron Carter, who's worked with Stanley Nelson for years. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we spend much of today's show with the legendary filmmaker Stanley Nelson, one of the leading documentarians of our time, as we turn to his latest documentary, Attica, with Tracy Curry, which tells the story of the deadliest prison uprising in U.S. history in 1971, when prisoners at the Attica Correctional Facility in upstate New York rebelled on September 9th, 1971, overpowering guards, taking over much of the prison to protest conditions before they were brutally suppressed. Stanley Nelson's extraordinary new film is nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature. This is his first nomination in his more than three-decade-long career, making more than 30 films. He is a three-time Primetime Emmy winner, two for his work on Freedom Riders, which was added to the National Film Registry in the Library of Congress in 2020. This is the trailer for Attica.
Attica was fear.
It was 70% black and brown. Prisoners, all white guards. What could go wrong?
Grab the guards, grab the keys.
All hell broke loose.
Tell me this. Are these primarily blacks?
Guys were complaining about the basic things like toothpaste. A roll of toilet paper would last you a month.
The inmates were considered like animals.
They beat you up in your cell, and they take you to segregation, and sometimes you don't come back.
Have the inmates made any demands?
There are all kinds of demands for a change in the whole world.
This had to be mediated, otherwise it was going to end in disaster. They wanted to use those weapons.
Put your hands in the air, and you will not be harmed.
You will not be harmed.
You will not be harmed. But that was bullshit.
They want to kill us.
We are men.
He was waking up America.
Somebody had to take a stand.
That's the trailer for Attica, the new documentary on Showtime that's actually streaming for free on YouTube until the end of Black History Month. Co-directed by the legendary filmmaker Stanley Nelson, nominated for his first Academy Award. We're going to play some clips. But Stanley, let's start with why you made this film about the deadliest prison uprising in this country. They started September 9th. 1971, and Governor Nelson Rockefeller called out the state troopers who opened fire on September 13th.
I felt that the story of Attica had never really been told. You know, I was around when Attica happened in 71, but I never knew, you know, why the prisoners rebelled. I never knew why Rockefeller and law enforcement went in Attica and just slaughtered the inmates and the guards. So I thought that there was so much of the story that I didn't know, and I think that this is a really one of the really important American events that happened over the last 50 years.
I want to go to the next clip, and that's if you could set it up the first night, Stanley. The first night of the uprising.
Yeah, when the prisoners took over, one of the things that is important that we understand about Attica is that they held 40 guards and civilian workers hostage, so law enforcement couldn't come in. And this clip is about the first night where they're actually out in the yard, you know, at night for the first time, and there's really, as one prisoner says, exuberation. And there's really a sense that they're doing something that will change the prison system forever. And also a sense of freedom from not being locked up at night, many for the first time in a long time.
Let's go to that clip.
The guy next to me was named Raymond White. He was walking around, looking up in the air. It was dark. Yo, Raymond White. Yo, Ray. You all right? He said, man, I ain't been out after dark in 22 years.
And we was talking, singing songs. It was a festive night. I loved it. I loved it, man. I was out in the nighttime looking at the stars. I was drunk. I was happy. You know, I liked it, you know. I was having a good time.
And it was good. I felt free. Prison was there, but, you know, I felt free. I didn't have to hear the doors locking. And if it was a good feeling at that first night.
When it got dark, and everybody was talking about finding somewhere to sleep, but, you know, don't sleep alone and, you know, that type of thing. There's a lot of psychopaths and sociopaths in those facilities. So, you know, you had to protect yourself from your peers even.
I knew this was going to last forever. I knew there would be an end to this. But just because we was incarcerated, it didn't mean that we were less than human. Somebody had to take a stand.
A clip from the Oscar-nominated film Attica. So that's the first night. If you could talk about the conditions, and let's be clear, that was September 9th, 1971. It was basically 2 weeks after George Jackson was killed by prison guards at San Quentin. And talk about the significance, his inspiration for these prisoners, and then what they were protesting, Stanley.
I think one of the things that was important is that, you know, this was 71. And so there's protests going on all over the country. You know, the Black Panthers, the Young Lords, the prisoners are reading Malcolm X. And George Jackson is a real hero to the prisoners in Attica for his writings. And when George Jackson was killed, the prisoners just felt that, you know, it was the last straw. And they go on a hunger strike. And what they do is, you know, they refuse to eat. And it's not only the Black prisoners, but it's the white prisoners and the Puerto Rican prisoners. And that was really different because one of the things that the prison system did was separate the prisoners by race and kind of pitted one race against the other. And so the death of George Jackson was really an inciting incident in the takeover of Attica.
I want to go back to Attica, in which the prisoners describe their reasons for taking guards as hostages, why Muslim prisoners were trusted to protect those hostages.
When we got the DR with the hostages, we hollered, "We got hostages!" And you had about 1,000 men shouting that out. We know we need hostages to keep the police from coming and vamping on us. You gotta have hostages. That's your only leverage.
As long as they had the hostages, they didn't have guns and they didn't have this and they didn't have that, but they had hostages and they're your people and you're responsible for your people. You're responsible to protect your people. And do your job. Sit down, negotiate with us.
Getting into the area where the 21 hostages are being held, they're in that main group.
We can't distinguish them because the prisoners have taken their clothing away and put prison clothes on.
They were blindfolded in a circle in the middle of the yard. They also had guards, inmate guards, that were around them protecting them.
And we seen them as captives. We seen them as people who were in under our supervision. So we couldn't do harm to them. Our understanding of Islam was that you don't harm a captive. Therefore, it was decided to allow the Muslim brothers to look out for them.
A clip from the Oscar-nominated documentary Attica. Stanley Nelson, take it from there in these days. The prisoners taking hostages, their demands to be treated as human beings, their call for that observers committee, everyone from William Kunstler to David Rothenberg to Clarence Jones, the publisher of the Amsterdam News. Talk about that scene and how they understood they needed protection. We're just about to talk about what Governor Nelson Rockefeller did.
And one of the things that the prisoners realized right away was that because they had hostages, they had a certain amount of control. So one of the things that they did was invited an observer committee, which included some of the people that you named, because they thought that those people would be sympathetic and honest in the negotiations with the prisoners for their demands. Another really important thing for the whole incident and for us as filmmakers were that the prisoners invited the media in because they felt that the media would film this whole thing and that would give them a certain amount of protection. And so that the media would film the treatment of the hostages and know that the hostages, people outside would know that the hostages were treated fairly. And so it for us as filmmakers, there's just incredible footage of the whole uprising because the media was invited in and kind of given in many ways, you know, a free rein to film the whole incident. That went on for 5 days.
I want to go to this final clip we've got of your film, Attica, prisoners describing the living arrangements they established during the uprising.
You took a stick and you put a sheet over it and pulled it back, and that was your sleeping quarters. By the time guys started having to go to the bathrooms, none were working. The guys that had been to Vietnam and been in the Army, they said, we got to make a latrine. They knew what a latrine was. I didn't know what a latrine was. There was this brother, and I said brother, he was white. They call him Tiny. And he was like a nurse before the Attica Rebellion happened. They set up a medical section in the yard for anybody who had any problems to go, and then Tiny would take care of them. And the medical attention in the yard was much better than the medical attention we got throughout the years.
Oh, man, we had a good time. We was making wine and cooking food outside. It was like a big picnic, like a shanty town. You know, like Deadwood when Buffalo Bill was out.
You ever watch Gunsmoke, the Western? Well, Matt Dillon was the sheriff marshal of Gunsmoke. He kept order. In D.R., we didn't have a Matt Dillon. Every man was a law unto himself. He did whatever the hell you wanted to do. There was no order.
That's a clip from Attica. If you can then describe, Stanley Nelson, what happened next. As the prisoners thought that they were negotiating, dealing with the hostages, dealing with the Observers Committee, what was Governor Nelson Rockefeller doing in his final act?
Well, first, I think it's important to understand that the prisoners had 30 demands, and 28 of those demands the head of prisons had already met. You know, more toilet paper and more showers, small things like that. So, 28 of the 30 demands were met, and finally, Governor Rockefeller, Nelson Rockefeller of New York, was in charge of the prison system. But he, you know, nobody understood that he was on the phone with Richard Nixon, and Richard Nixon was encouraging him not to meet the final demands, not to go up to Attica, because the prisoners were asking for Rockefeller to just come up to the prison. And the Observer Committee was asking for Rockefeller, just come to the prison. You don't have to go inside. You know, just show some concern. And Rockefeller refuses to do that, and instead gives an ultimatum and finally orders law enforcement, over 500 state troopers and former guards and guards, into Attica with guns and rifles.
And talk about how many people died, how many of them hostages. What was understood then, what was learned later, something that the prisoners continually repeated about who killed the hostages.
Yeah, 39 people died, 8 or 9 hostages were killed, and immediately it comes out in the news and the national news and all the reporting that the hostages had slipped, the inmates had slit the hostages' throats and killed the hostages, and that's what's reported on the national media, and, you know, after the first day. And in fact, you know, Richard Nixon, President Richard Nixon, calls Rockefeller to congratulate him on the retaking of the prison.
As we talk about institutional racism, I wanted to go to a broader question about what's happening today in the United States with African-Americans and the police. You have a film coming up about this, but there are currently 2 federal hate crimes trials going on in St. Paul, Minnesota. There's the federal civil rights trial of the 3 former police officers involved in George Floyd's murder. In Georgia, jurors at the hate crimes trial of Ahmaud Arbery's murderers were shown graphic images of Arbery's autopsy. One One juror has asked the judge if there's money for counseling available after hearing the racist language used by the murderers and viewing these images of the damage to Arbery's bodies caused by the two close-range blasts from Travis McMichael's 12-gauge shotgun. Then you've got Texas, a grand jury indicting 19 Austin police officers on charges of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon for their roles in violently suppressing Black Lives Matter protests in 2020. News of the indictments came just hours after Austin approved $10 million settlement with two protesters injured by police. And then you've got this video, the New Jersey NAACP calling on the Bridgewater Police Department to remove the officers filmed breaking up a fight by violently arresting a black teen while allowing an older white teen to remain free. The video is just horrifying as the white teen is put on a couch and the police officers put a knee on the back of the 14-year-old black boy, and then they handcuff him. Stanley Nelson, you're one of the leading documentarians of the black American experience. Can you talk about your response to all of this coming together now? Not that it hasn't come together every day in U.S. history.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things that has happened is that because, you know, everybody's walking around with a phone, you know, that has a camera, we're seeing these things, you know, videotaped and pictures of these things. And so that we can't deny it anymore, or the general public can't deny it. The police can't deny it in the same way. But we're just starting a film on the history of African-Americans and the police. And I think the one thing we have to understand is these things are not just happening for the first time. These things are being filmed for the first time from the time of the police evolving from slave catchers. There's been this very negative relationship between African Americans and the police. The difference is, you know, now we're seeing it, and we're seeing it in a way that can be played back, and so that we're starting to understand it in a different way, and hopefully we're starting to understand the police in a different way. I think that in some ways, you know, it's reflected on Attica, the film that we did on Attica, because people are receiving it in a different way. Because people are, I think, hopefully, a lot of people are less prone to just believe whatever law enforcement says.
I wanted to end with a clip of your upcoming film on Frederick Douglass. He celebrated February 14th as his birthday, though the exact date of his birth has not been recorded. I wanted to go to a clip.
In the summer of 1841, a grand anti-slavery convention was held in Nantucket. I was induced to express the feelings inspired by the occasion and the fresh recollection of the scenes through which I had passed as a slave.
The abolitionists that were there knew that they had this fugitive slave in the audience, and they asked Frederick, "Will you tell the audience what it was like to be enslaved?"
What shall I say of this experience? I have seen the cruelty and brutality of slavery. And I had been subjected to the depths of slave life. I was a graduate from this peculiar institution, with my diploma written on my back.
More Americans heard Douglass speak than any other American in the 19th century, with the possible exception of Mark Twain. And it was significant that a former slave was famous.
Frederick Douglass understood the power of his literature as a tactic of liberation. A man born enslaved who rose to become a man of growth, of self-mastery.
Frederick Douglass has a very clear idea of what becoming means. He is becoming an orator. He's becoming a world leader. He's becoming a statesman. And for him, becoming is an ever-unfolding process that he sees as self-creation.
The teaser for the forthcoming documentary, Becoming Frederick Douglass, courtesy of Maryland Public Television, that's coming out in the fall, as well as a documentary on Harriet Tubman. Stanley Nelson, we have just 30 seconds. Your career has spanned more than 30 years, more than 30 amazing documentaries. How does it feel to be nominated for your first Oscar?
It feels great. You know, I mean, it feels great. I think, you know, one of the things that's so wonderful about it is that more people will see Attica, you know, and for some people, the fact that we're nominated, you know, is validation and a reason to see Attica. And that's what we want. You know, I think that.
Well, it is long overdue. Thank you so much, Stanley Nelson. That does it for our show. A very happy birthday to Neil Shabata. I'm Amy Goodman. Please stay safe.
Vem magar lenha, rojão. Traz a lenha pro fogão. Vem fazer armação. Hoje é dia de sol. Alegria de Coió. É curtir o verão.
Vem magar lenha, rojão. Traz a lenha pro fogão. Vem fazer armação. Hoje é dia de sol. Alegria de Coió. É curtir o verão.
Yeah.
Vem, vaga.